Good morning. Welcome back to the Broadcast Retirement Network. This is BRN Sunday for Sunday, April 7th, 2024. And we've got another great show for you this week. We've got David Levine, one half of the Legal Eagles, and also a principal with Groom Law Group here to help break down some new retirement litigation themes. And then Oliver Rennick will be here to break down the jobs report and its impact to economic data in the future and inflation. So sit back, relax, enjoy this episode of BRN Sunday. Welcome back. Now time to take a look on what's happening on Capitol Hill. And joining us online, he is one half of the famed Legal Eagles, David Levine. He is a principal with Groom Law Group. That's an employee benefits law firm based in Washington, D.C. David, so great to talk to you. Thanks for popping by the program this morning.
Yes, thanks for having me. It's been a while since I've flown solo.
That's true. But, you know, we enjoy having you and Kevin on together, but also solo when, and, you know, of course, it's based on your schedule. Let's talk about, I think we wanted to talk a little bit more about litigation. I think your last appearance, because we were off because of the Easter holiday, I think we talked about the PRT litigation, but we want to kind of turn our attention to other forms of retirement litigation.
Absolutely. And why do we sort of go there at this point, Jeff? It's because, you know, we spend so much time on legislation, regulation, all the uns that we talk about. Yep. But litigation, every so often we do a segment on it. And the question that comes up a lot is, where is it today? And I thought today maybe we could just sort of do a brief catch up on that. We talked about PRT. We're not going to go there. There is the traditional world of fee litigation. Your record keeping, your TPA, other services, you paid too much, or your investments were too expensive, or you could have gotten a cheaper share class or a better investment. That train keeps rolling down the track. And I'm sure, as many listeners know, that there's a lawsuit filed on that weekly, if not more frequently than that. Our pace has picked up this year. Last year was a little bit of a dip in the volume in terms of the number of these lawsuits, but it was still in the double digits. It just wasn't 100 like in a year before, in a prior year. Mm-hmm. But the pace, we continue apace. But I think the big thing to keep in mind is that these lawsuits are diversifying. One of the big examples of diversification in this lawsuit is, and even in the last week we've had another lawsuit on this, is lawsuits being brought by plaintiffs alleging that the use of forfeitures inside 401k plans. And yes, if you have a plan that 100% vests everybody, you can tune out now for this portion. But for a lot of plans have a vesting schedule that says if you work 3 years or 5 years, that's when you fully vest in your employer contributions. You're always vested in your own employee money, of course. And there have been a series of lawsuits saying that when a set of plan forfeitures are used to offset employer contributions. In other words, if an employer owes $100,000 total for the payroll period in match, and there's $5,000 of forfeitures, the Internal Revenue Code and ERISA, there's guidance on this, allows you to offset your contributions mm-hmm. of $100,000 by that $5,000 and put in $95,000. And then get another $5,000 using the forfeitures to pay for it. Pretty standard, widely accepted. And in fact, over the past many years, Congress and the IRS have clarified the wide range of permissible uses for forfeitures. And they've made it crystal clear. Plaintiffs are now asserting, as you could tell as a defense lawyer, I disagree with this position, are now asserting that it's a breach of fiduciary duty for a plan to use forfeitures to offset employer contributions where they should be used for other purposes. There's lots of discussions about what does your plan document language say? What is your process that you can get into? But to me, this is an example, whether or not you agree with these lawsuits, of the evolving nature of litigation. So a great example is look at how you use your forfeitures and evaluate, do you change? Do you not? Is there a reason? What's your basis? As I'm saying, I don't agree with the lawsuits, but that's part of the discussion. Similarly, you continue to see lawsuits that go in a lot of directions. You can continue to see lawsuits about different types of plans, whether whether it's multiple employer plan and pooled employer plans. You might see it involving group of plans. You see it on unique areas. You see them involving multi-employer plans. You see them, whereas before it was like the big mega corporation. Now, whether it's a 403B or anything, you see them all over the map. And that's another area where we continue to see a lot of litigation at this point. So that's another area. Go ahead, Jeff. You were going to ask a
Oh yeah,
question.
I was going to ask you a question. I mean, how common is it, David, when there's established guidance and forfeiture, let's just take forfeiture as an example. These protocols and procedures have been in place for, I mean, since when I was a record keeper and over 15, 20 years ago. So how common is it for litigation to come back? It seems to me as a layperson, not an attorney, they're actually challenging the regulation or the procedures that were established in totality. They're not necessarily challenging a particular plan, right? Because if you're talking about the prioritization, where does this money get used? Is it used to offset company contributions? Is it used to pay plan expenses? Isn't some of that already settled, I guess, is my question.
Oh, Jeff, I completely concur. I would have argued it was long settled, but in essence, these lawsuits and the plaintiffs' lawyers, believe they have a case to make here, and that's them. These lawsuits sort of say it's nice that the and I'm paraphrasing, and not all of them say this, but a number of them say, okay, well, that's nice that regulation says that. That doesn't control. They'll sometimes try. As you know, and I'm sure many of the listeners do, ERISA is a funky law. Why? Because it has provisions in the Internal Revenue Code, so the code rules where you get regulations, but it also has provisions in that are labor law driven, which winds up with the Department of Labor, the Employee Benefits Security Administration. So there's like multiple places it shows up, and there's actually law in place which divvies up so-called Reorganization Plan Number 4. That divvies up how the Department of Labor handles some things and some is handled by the IRS because the language overlaps. But some of these lawsuits on forfeitures, and also similarly, you've seen this in the defined benefit plan space on actuarial assumption lawsuits, basically says, well, the regulations say this, but this, it does either A, it doesn't address it, the specific nuance, which I would respectfully disagree with, or what it also says is, well, that doesn't bind for over here. So the plaintiffs, there are some very smart lawyers. Again, do we agree? No, but they're coming up with theories that sort of say, notwithstanding that, we have questions, and it raises some real, like, theoretical, like, sort of big picture questions. Because if you can say, well, there's a regulation, but it's beyond that, and you can do this, what else is there out there open for challenge? And what type of instability does that create in the landscape? Remembering the retirement system is a voluntary item. It's complex enough. People need some comfort that if they rely on the framework out there, that they're not going to face a potential whipsaw. And it is a real concern for many.
Yeah, and to your to that point, again, not a legal scholar by any means, but I'm just talking from the practical as a practical person. If you're going to go through, and this is the tip of the iceberg in terms of challenging the application of rules and what the rules exist, that creates a whole lot of instability. And also, David, it creates. So I'm all for supporting. Making sure that participants get what they need to get in terms of the benefits, making sure that they're taken care of. I get that. But when you start to do this, now you have these expensive lawsuits that ultimately, because having someone, experienced attorney and a law firm provide experience, that has a cost to it. And where does that cost? That cost actually gets paid out of either plan assets or gets borne by the employer, and actually can have a deleterious effect against the benefits that the employee is receiving. So, in my opinion, I mean, again, I'm giving my opinion. This is not your
Of
opinion,
course.
not Kevin's opinions. But where do you draw the line here?
Well, I think as someone on the defense side, I completely agree. There is no unlimited money growing on a money tree, and costs get carried through, whether it is if there's a lot of frictional costs, people do they pay it, whether it's legal fees or other costs. Does it get mean reduced benefits? Does it mean reduce salaries? Does it mean higher insurance premiums and still then reduce other things? It could be all over the map. To me, this goes to something that Kevin and I know we've talked to you in one of our prior sessions, Jeff, on this about, for instance, there is the case of the Supreme Court right now about that may reduce the deference to agency decisions. And as you know, we have great respect for regulators. Do we agree on everything? No. And sometimes do us and others challenge the regulator's position? Yes. And if the so-called Chevron deference we've talked about in the past, where basically the court since the 80s set a very the Supreme Court set a very high standard for deferring to agency determinations and interpretations that may get dialed back by the Supreme Court very soon. If that does, it maybe when we disagree with the regulators might make for strong arguments to push back on them, especially in court. But it could also lead to more of these types of lawsuits because, as plaintiffs say, well, the regulation isn't determinative. That type of decision could undermine it. So we're definitely in a state of flux. If I'm a sponsor right now or a service provider, I think my real takeaway is thinking about it's that game of whack-a-mole. How do you constantly think about adjusting and tweaking your process, your plan language? There's no one right or wrong answer here, but I think the forfeitures is just an example of things you just have to be willing to constantly adapt and update your processes as you think is necessary, because in some cases, it's not.
Yeah, and I think anyone who thinks retirement is not dynamic as an industry, all you got to do is listen to what David's talking about. I mean, it is continuously changing in, with respect to this issue, but also the types of products and services that are being offered. It is rather dynamic. David, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for popping by the program, and we look forward to having you and Kevin back on next week. Take care, my friend.
Thank you so much, Jeff, and thank you everybody for listening.
Bye, David. Have a great weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Imagine a new television network that will make you richer, healthier, and in control of your financial future. This network is for the policewoman in Nashville, Tennessee, the baker in Dubuque, Iowa, the teacher in Lexington, Kentucky. We want to make the idea of savings and retirement culturally relevant. But what do you see as a defining issue of the midterms? Especially for the smaller businesses. I mean, they are the lifeblood of the American economy. Featuring exclusive interviews, current affairs, and docuseries. 33 years old, you retired early.
The philosophy is money only matters if it helps you live a life that you love.
But you got to start thinking about retirement as soon as you get in.
The Broadcast Retirement Network will drive very high engagement with premium partnerships. So this isn't retirement and savings for your parents or grandparents. This is for all Americans. And we're going to change the way you think about money. Welcome to the next frontier of retirement and savings. This is BRN, the Broadcast Retirement Network.
Welcome back. Now, Time to take a look at markets. Joining us on the line, Oliver Rennick is the lead anchor for the Schwab Network. Oliver, thanks so much for joining us on the program this morning.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure to chat with you. All right, Oliver, let's start with jobs. I'm going to talk about the markets in a minute. Give us your reaction to the 303,000 jobs created during the month of March and the unemployment rate on or around 3.8%.
Yeah, huge number, and it continues to paint a very impressive picture of the U.S. economy. Analysts and economists just have not been able to keep up with the strength of the economy, the resilience of the consumer, the lack of impact of spending and debt to slow things down. It's just not manifesting itself. We have stock markets at all-time highs. We have employment firm. We have a Fed open to the idea of loosening conditions further. It's just a pretty good situation right now. And this week's jobs print was a pretty good way to cap a compelling week for economic data. Now, some of that data does suggest inflationary forces still lingering, especially a surprise comeback in the manufacturing economy, with the ISM manufacturing printing above 50 early in the week. That was a bit of a shocker, but the writing has been on the wall there for anyone who's been wanting to pay attention that manufacturing would bounce back. So that was interpreted negatively by the market because it included a rise in prices paid for manufacturing, which is not something that really has been in the conversation for a couple of years. So that was kind of interpreted as an inflationary impulse. But then a couple of days later, you had the other side of the economy, the bigger one for the U.S., which is the services economy, still above 50, still expanding, still very strong and firm, but with a sizable drop in the prices paid for services, which is very disinflationary. So that brought confidence back to the market that things are good and that inflation is not going to be too scary. And so the jobs report on Friday with a big splashy headline number without a commensurate shock in wages was kind of another sweet spot. And as of the time we are talking, markets are doing well and helping to recover some losses and just general sluggishness the last couple weeks in some of the big tech stuff. So it was really about as good of a week for economic data as you could have asked for.
And Oliver, if you're the Federal Reserve, rate cuts is something we always talk with you and others about on this network, and you, of course, cover it on the Schwab Network twice a day. But if you're the Fed, what's the outlook look like for rate cuts, potential rate cuts? Because, as you said, markets took a little bit of a dip, maybe perceived certain indicators that led people to kind of have a sell-off. But what is the Fed – how does the Fed react to all this information?
Well, it probably should give them confidence in the economy sufficient enough to avoid cutting rates in a fast or aggressive manner. It doesn't mean that they can't do it down the road, but the data right now just seem to skew the risks away from, you know, lowering rates further. It's just the risk right now, and we did hear some commentary from Fed officials using this turn of phrase that the risk is bigger to cut than it is to not. That's kind of a more hawkish development in some of the language from the Fed speakers, Mester and Kashkari this week, Bostic generally. Most of the Fed speakers kind of erred more on what you might call a hawkish angle, but generally the market is still pretty convinced, higher than 50% chance, that we're going to get interest rate cuts in June or July. But June is now coming down to basically a coin flip. It probably should be dropping even further, but there are still reasons to hope for further disinflationary trends. And a lot of folks are convinced that what we've seen the last few months of hot inflation prints are going to be temporary. Now, it seems to me pretty clear that the data this week suggests that the odds of those warm inflation prints were temporary are pretty low. It seems like the inflation that we're getting is going to be pretty sticky at this level. So it seems the reason that cuts may not happen this year, but it shouldn't be a huge, huge problem for markets unless it happens as some other threat presents itself, which could just be a running out of gas after a really epic, frothy rally the last 3 months. And that's kind of what I've spent more time monitoring, is whether or not those animal spirits are subsiding for any reason that doesn't necessarily have to be Fed related.
Yeah. And Oliver, let's look out into the next week. what's going on from the network's perspective, and what do you plan to cover? I know you can't give it all away, but what do you plan to cover? And what are you thinking about as we roll into more economic data? I think the inflation numbers come out,
yep.
Other information. So what's next week look like? Let's talk a little bit about the outlook.
Inflation, definitely important. Now that we have confidence in the economy, the Fed can't really hide behind a fear about employment breaking down. So that means that inflation prints, if they do come in warm, should have a bit more impact than they did the last couple months. Stocks generally absorbed data very well in the last couple months, even when inflation prints came in hot. But the 10-year yield is basically right at the year-to-date highs. The dollar is very close. So if those two things are breaking out, then stocks are probably going to start caring more about inflation in the Fed. But you need to really see that happen. So you need to see the 10-year yield push basically through to 4.5 and the dollar to get to 105. If those things happen, then my guess would be stocks are under some pressure. But other than the macro stuff, we do have earnings, and JP Morgan the next Friday is going to be the first real important company to look at for earnings.
Yeah. Well, folks, if you want to get the latest, all the information, of course, you can come to BRN, but you can go to see Oliver Rennick and his colleagues on the Schwab Network. Oliver, what time do you guys start coverage? 8 o'clock, is that right? 8 in the morning?
My coverage starts at 8 a.m. Central, but Ben is on futures before me at 7 a.m., so I guess 8 Eastern, yeah.
Yeah, well, 8 Eastern, and you can do anyone else can do the math to figure out the other time zones around the country. Oliver, and around the world, I should say, because you have global followers, Oliver. They want to tap into the Oliver Rennick analysis like we do. Oliver Rennick, great to talk to you. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. We'll talk to you again very soon, my friend.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. And that wraps up this episode of BRN Sunday. Have a topic of interest, someone you think we should talk to? Then drop us a line. And don't forget, for all the latest curated news and lifestyle, wellness, finance, tech, so much more in all in one place, check out today's edition of our daily newsletter, The Morning Pulse. Want to search our archives, check out our latest content? Well, then visit our website. We're back again tomorrow with another edition of BRN AM. We'll have a very special guest and another important topic. Until then, I'm Jeff Snyder. Stay safe, keep on saving, and don't forget, roll with the changes.